We're going to get started. All right, thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome to the panel sponsored by the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. I'm supposed to emphasize that because apparently some of you may be confused about Columbia A versus Columbia B. If you're looking for the in-house counsel panel, that's in the other room. So if you leave now, we'll make fun of you on your way out. All right, I'm Albert Lin. I chair the appellate practice at Hunt and Andrews Kurth, but more relevant to this function, I also chair the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. I have two very brief functions today. First, I'm supposed to remind you or educate you about practice groups. So for those of you who don't know, the practice groups are grouped by substantive area of law. There's an executive committee that meets once a month, and what the volunteers on the practice groups do is track developments in the law and plan educational events like this, debates, the FedSoc forums, the in-person programs, the panels that you see that FedSoc puts out. So if you're not involved with the practice groups and you have an interest in doing so, you can come talk to me or you can reach out to Nate Kaczmarek, who runs the practice groups. My second function is that I have the privilege of introducing the moderator for this panel, and that's Judge Dan Bress. Judge Bress sits on the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. A native of Gilroy, California, Judge Bress graduated magna cum laude from Harvard College and received his JD from the University of Virginia School of Law down the road from here, where he served as editor-in-chief of the Virginia Law Review. Following law school, Judge Bress clerked for Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson of the Fourth Circuit, and then for Justice Scalia. And before his appointment to the bench in 2019, Judge Bress was a partner at Kirkland & Ellis. So with that, please welcome Judge Bress, who will then introduce the panelists. Thank you.
Okay, Albert, thank you so much, and I want to extend my warmest welcome to everybody here. I'm glad you found us. It's not the Mayflower, it's a little different, so the muscle memory is off, but it's the same great people and the same great discussions. I want to also welcome everyone who's watching online, and particularly all the law students. It's great to have everybody here. The panel that we're going to have today is entitled Federalism and Separation of Powers, a Revival of Separation of Powers at the Supreme Court. Now, the way that the Federalist Society titled this panel, they ended that sentence with a question mark. But perhaps the sentence should end with a period, or maybe even an exclamation mark. It's fair to say that in the last several years, and particularly in the last term, the Supreme Court has brought renewed focus to the structural features of the Constitution, and particularly its most enduring structural feature, the separation of powers among Congress, the executive, and the judiciary. I'm often reminded, so often actually, of Justice Scalia, my old boss, who is one of the country's foremost thinkers on the separation of powers. And in speeches and articles, you may have heard him say this, Justice Scalia liked to quote a provision from a Bill of Rights that sounded so good in theory, such as this one: citizens are guaranteed freedom of speech, of the press, and of assembly. And he would then tell the audience that he was actually quoting from the 1977 Constitution of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. But the point was that this document, the founding document's structural features, were central to the framers' ingenious plan for protecting individual rights. And as Justice Scalia once wrote, structure is everything. That concept is going to guide us as our panel takes up and examines the Supreme Court's most recent decisions in this really important area of constitutional law. So we're going to discuss a few key cases. We're going to discuss Loper-Bright, in which the Supreme Court overturned the Chevron doctrine. We'll discuss the seeming reinvigoration of the non-delegation doctrine and the emergence of the major questions doctrine. We'll also discuss SEC versus Jarkissi, in which the Supreme Court held that the Seventh Amendment required the SEC to seek civil penalties before an Article III court rather than an agency adjudicator. And lastly, we're going to cover the Supreme Court's seminal decision on presidential immunity in Trump versus United States. And what we're going to ask is what these decisions mean for our understanding of the Constitution's separation of powers and where the Supreme Court may be heading in these areas. So, our speakers today have sworn a blood oath that this will be a discussion and that no person will drone on too long. And so, to protect that individual right, the panel has agreed on a very intricate structure for preserving that. And so here's our format. Each of the speakers is going to give a several-minute introduction on this general topic and offer their introductory remarks. And then what we're going to do is each panel member will take the lead in presenting a different area, and then we'll have discussions surrounding that. And after all that is done, we'll have time for questions. So I want to now introduce today's speakers. It's so tempting to immediately applaud for your favorite expert on the separation of powers. I'm going to ask you to just hold your applause until the end. So I'm going to start with Russell Balikian. Russell is a partner at Gibson Dunn here in Washington. He's a graduate of Yale Law School. He clerked for Judge Diane Sykes, Judge Gregory Katsas, and then Justice Thomas on the Supreme Court. Russell has extensive litigation experience, both before courts and administrative agencies, particularly in the telecom and technology sectors. Jeanette Brown is the general counsel and senior litigation counsel at the New Civil Liberties Alliance. Jeanette has 25 years of litigation experience in law firms in Washington, D.C. and Denver. And now in public interest work, Jeanette is focused on the Administrative Procedure Act, natural resources law, takings issues, and other constitutional claims. Roman Martinez, on the far end, is a partner at Latham & Watkins in Washington, D.C. Between his time in private practice and as an assistant to the Solicitor General, Roman has argued 14 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, including in Loper Bright. Roman has also argued dozens of appeals in federal courts of appeals. He's a graduate of Yale Law School. He was a law clerk to then D.C. Circuit Judge Brett Kavanaugh and later Chief Justice John Roberts. And Luke McLeod joins us. He's a partner at Williams & Connolly, a graduate of Harvard Law School. Luke clerked for Judge Kavanaugh, then on the D.C. Circuit, Judge Niemeyer on the Fourth Circuit, and then Justice Sotomayor on the Supreme Court. Luke is an experienced appellate advocate, having argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in many courts of appeal. And I believe Luke has won nearly every Rising Star award that I'm personally aware of. All those awards that say best under 40, the under 40 is the best part. So with that, please join me in welcoming our panelists. So now we're going to hear from each of the panelists, and I'm going to just start here with Russell and ask you to please kick us off.
Sure. Yeah, so the question presented in the panel is there a revival of the separation of powers at the Supreme Court? And I think absolutely. And if by that, at least if you mean that the Supreme Court is really taking seriously arguments about the separation of powers, I think you can see that in each of the decisions that Judge Bress just mentioned. You can see it in the major questions doctrine's development over the last couple years. You can see it in the Dobbs decision when it's overruling Roe versus Wade. Separation of powers wasn't necessarily explicitly invoked there, but that's really a separation of powers decision. What's the proper role of the judiciary? You can see it in the procedural decisions that the court has made available challenges to administrative action more broadly. So this past term in Corner Post, the decision on the statute of limitations to be able to bring an APA claim, that's going to run from the time of injury, so that past agency actions that you may not have had a chance to challenge, you actually can now bring those challenges. And obviously, an APA claim is almost inherently a separation of powers claim. You're talking about, does the agency have authority under the statute that Congress has enacted? Certainly other cases as well, but I, you know, just to confirm, I did a Westlaw search to see if separation of powers is appearing more frequently in recent cases, and it is. So it's an exciting time, and I think that brings with it two points, at least from the perspective of an advocate in private practice. The first is that this is a time for creative constitutional arguments. This is a time to assess your case, to assess what the authority of the government's action is. Can you trace it to a statute? Can you trace the statute to an authorization in the Constitution? If you're before an agency, can you trace the authority of the officials that you're appearing before all the way through the constitutional prerequisites. This is a time to really seriously assess those arguments and to bring them, because the Supreme Court takes them seriously, and as a result, the lower courts should take them seriously. At the same time, I think it's also a call for credibility, for responsibility. So there's this great opportunity now to be able to make good constitutional arguments, and so that carries with it some responsibility. Not every question is a major question. Not every ambiguity or hard interpretive issue in a statute is going to implicate the major questions doctrine. And I think for particularly for advocates and others who care about the development of the separation of powers, finding the right cases to bring those claims can really help. Finding the wrong cases to bring those claims can result in some adverse precedent and setbacks. I think it's just sort of common sense. Don't make bad arguments in cases, make good arguments in cases. But I think particularly as the court has kind of opened up the door for these types of challenges, I think it's incumbent on all of us to be able to raise those arguments creatively, but also responsibly. So, that.
Great. Jeanette?
Thank you. And I want to thank the Federalist Society for having me here. I agree that there is a resurgence of the separation of powers at the Supreme Court. It's interesting, though, when you look, I've tried to squint at the tea leaves and see sort of the causation element. And within, if you look only within the cases, I think it's difficult to see the causation element. But I think if you look at the history of what's going on with the administrative state, I think that we reached a tipping point, or what I would call a fixing point, where for years, for decades, really, I've practiced in the West and some Western lands issues. The erosion of liberty was very incremental, literally sort of out there, road by road, habitat by habitat. But we reached a point, and you know, whether it was the 70s and 80s, whether we've accelerated since then, we've reached a point where the administrative state has became so bold. And their positions, for example, the position they took in the Jarkissi case that we'll discuss, were so dangerous that I think that the court really needed to reach this point of re-examining what their role is in enforcing liberty. And I think you see that in some of the opinions, and particularly some of the things that Justice Gorsuch wrote about the role of the judiciary. And so I think that we do need to take this opportunity. We're, I think, just scratching the surface of where we need to go in terms of separation of powers. Judge Oldham this morning talked about how it's so important that the judiciary is independent. That's true, but what these separation of powers cases show, and particularly the Loper-Bright, we call it relentless. I'm with the New Civil Liberties Alliance, so we call it relentless. What the Loper-Bright relentless cases and Jarkissi case show is that judges also have to do their job when they're independent, and for some amount of time, they were not exercising their full power. They were not necessarily filling the role that the Constitution had given to them. And it's been a long time since people have been advocating for a change in that. For example, Philip Hamburger had a book, I think it was in 2008, about the law and judicial duty. And you can't get to the other separation of powers issue or issues such as vested powers if the court's not doing its duty. So I think that this is a wonderful jumping off place for people who are interested in separation of powers and constitutional law. I absolutely agree that we need to take advantage of the Loper-Bright relentless case and Jarkissi and move those cases forward, because just like the administrative state was bold in getting to where they are, and to some extent the author of their undoing, which we obviously pushed them over the line. But they are fighting just as hard now to fill that vacuum with something else. And so if you read the briefs of the government now, you know, no, they don't invoke Chevron, but they make the same arguments with different verbiage, different reasoning, but to get to the same place. And so I think it's super important that we're here. I think that Loper-Bright, Relentless, Jarkissi, these other cases, they're a major victory. We should not take it for granted, but also we can't rest on our laurels. We need to press forward. And you know, just like after Tuesday morning, I think the onus and the thought on all of us should be, okay, it's time to get to work. it's time to get to work, and we need to take this moment. And I'm thankful that the justices have helped have gotten us to this point, but they don't control the docket that's in front of them. To Russ's point, we need to bring these cases, and we need to be selective. I agree with that. The other thing I think that has helped lead to this moment was an increase in the conservative law movement. We've been behind in organization, in coordinating, and I think as we move forward and try to push these separation of powers arguments and other constitutional arguments that need to be made, we need to continue to work together and to coordinate. You know, if you're doing commercial litigation, there's some arguments that aren't going to come naturally. If I'm doing nonprofit work, there's some clients I'm probably not going to be able to serve. This is something that we all have to do together. And so I'm looking forward to working with everyone, hopefully in this room and certainly on this panel, to continue to advance the separation of powers and constitutional interests and individual rights specifically.
Great, thank you. Luke.
Thank you, Judge Brasson. Thank you to the Federalist Society. I'm not a member of the Society, but I really appreciate that you value a diversity of views, even if it means I may have to do a little penance with Justice Sotomayor later down the road. So I totally agree with what's been said so far, that separation of powers has been and remains a key feature of the court's docket. We saw that, of course, in OT-23, and I'm sure we'll talk about those cases. The question I have in my mind is whether we are really at the beginning of a revolution in the way that our Constitution and our government works, or whether the court is just tinkering around the edges. And so far, it seems to me to be more the latter than the former. That's not to say that there haven't been important decisions on the separation of powers in recent terms, Loper Bright Relentless, Jarkissi, both very important cases for reasons we'll discuss today. But so far, a majority of the court has not been willing to go the full hamburger. Sorry, Professor, if you're in the audience. And adopt rules that would really make much of the existing administrative state illegal, or that would significantly overhaul how administrative agencies carry out their day-to-day functions. Relatedly, there seems, at least to me, to be a real tension within the conservative majority on the court about how to go about the project of effectuating the separation of powers, even if there is wide agreement that that is a project worth pursuing. The other interesting big picture question that occurs to me as I look at the cases over the recent terms is, whose powers are we worried about separating? It seems obvious that the court is concerned with checking executive overreach, or at least certain kinds of executive overreach. It's also concerned, rightly I would say, that an already very weak Congress is giving up too much of its authority to the executive branch. But it's much less clear to me that the court cares about keeping the judiciary's power in check. And in fact, one of the things I think we'll see as we discuss today is that many of the cases involve not just a separation of powers, but also a rebalancing of power away from the executive, away from Congress, and toward justices and judges. So looking ahead, I think there are several key questions to keep an eye on. Will the court enforce real limits on executive agencies? If so, what are those limitations? Is the court aiming for a more moderate course of reining in the most egregious excesses but leaving most of the administrative state intact? Will we look forward 10 years from now, or look backwards 10 years from now, and say, this was the moment when we were on the precipice of a revolution in the way that our government works? Or will we say that this was part of a slow, gradual evolution in the separation of powers? I don't know the answers to those questions, but I look forward to exploring them with my colleagues today.
Thank you, Luke. And Roman.
Yes, thank you. And Luke, here's an application if you want to join. So thank you for inviting me to be on this panel, and thank you all for being here. Before talking about the separation of powers, I just wanted to acknowledge the passing yesterday of a great American lawyer and friend of the Federalist Society and mentor to me, Ted Olson. Ted was instrumental as I was becoming a lawyer. I went to work at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, was a summer associate. I met my wife, Dace, at the branded Ted Olson happy hour at Morton's. Ted throughout his career, advised and litigated some of the most important separation of power cases, including as a litigant himself in Morrison versus Olson. And he was just a great inspiration, whether we disagreed with him or agreed with him case by case. He was just a great lawyer and a great role model. And so we're sorry, and we will miss him. I thought I'd just make three quick points about the separation of powers, and they sort of track points I make about the court generally when I talk to audiences of both lawyers and non-lawyers and more friendly audiences that are maybe more predisposed to like what the court is doing and audiences that are more hostile. So I want to say something about nuance, about the middle of the court, and then about the excitement that might come. First, on nuance, I think it's probably fair to say that the separation of powers jurisprudence of the current court is nuanced. I don't think this court, we'll talk about Luke's interesting comments about the judiciary and the kind of re-tilting power maybe towards the courts, and I think there's some truth to that. But I think in general, I view what the court is doing is not being about promoting a super strong president or promoting a weak legislature, a strong legislature, being focused on the courts. I think that they're sort of tweaking and recalibrating the balance of power and the separation of powers across all of the agencies. So with respect to the president, for example, you have decisions over the last decade that have really tried to consolidate the president's control and ability to preside over a unitary or more unitary executive branch with really important decisions on appointments and removal powers. But at the same time, the practical powers of the presidency come through in today's sort of administrative state, in large part through his control of the executive agencies and also a significant influence even over independent agencies. And so the decisions that we've seen that have reined in, whether it's deference doctrines or the ability of agencies to do adjudication, I think also are seen as taking away presidential power in significant ways. So I think it's balanced. With respect to the courts as well, we've seen a number of cases, as Luke alluded to, where the courts have gotten more powerful in the sense that they actually have to do judging and have to interpret the law independently, especially in the Loper-Bright and Relentless decision. At the same time, though, I think I view the conservative majority, at least certain members of the court, as being interested in some ways in limiting the court's authorities. I think standing doctrine continues to be a very important area of interest for the conservative-leaning majority, which would limit the ability of courts to weigh in on certain cases, even when they're big and important and have very significant policy implications. I think some of the justices are very concerned about remedies. The nationwide vacator of rules, which you would think would be a big power for courts, I think there's a significant movement on the court to rein that in. So we'll have to see. And even with respect to congressional power, in some ways the court is trying to have Congress come in and legislate more. And the recess appointments decision from around a decade ago, I think, was very important in protecting the Senate's ability to influence appointments. But at the same time, the court is willing to overrule Congress when it oversteps its bounds, especially vis-a-vis the executive. So I think there's nuance. My second point, I just want to say, I do think that going forward, where we are now and going forward, I think that the different members of the court have different roles that they've been playing. And with respect to the conservative-leaning majority, I see, and this really came through to me when I was preparing for the oral argument in the Relentless case, it's just amazing how justices like Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh, especially on the D.C. Circuit, have laid the groundwork for a lot of these shifts by writing over and over again, whether it's law review articles or decisions or concurrences over the years. They've really built up an intellectual framework that is, we're sort of now seeing come into effect in actual decisions. That said, I do think that the middle of the court is going to be where the action is in figuring out how quickly and how far the court is going to go with respect to separation of powers cases. I tend to view the court as being sort of split in some ways 3-3-3. I think there's a meaningful difference in terms of outcomes and voting patterns with the Chief Justice, Justice Barrett, Justice Kavanaugh. And I tend to think that those three justices are going to drive the train. I asked not ChatGPT, but the Claude AI website last night to tell me what percentage of big separation of powers cases over the last 5 or 6 years Chief Justice Roberts had written. And basically, he's written like 80% of them. So this is a major area of interest for the chief. I think he's going to be continuing to really shape the doctrine in this area. And then the other vote that I think is really important to watch is Justice Barrett, who I think in terms of her background, maybe there's less to fully see in her writings because she has less of a paper trail on some of these separation of powers issues. But even in her short time on the court so far, we've seen her willing to be both bold but also nuanced in her thinking on a number of the issues that we're going to talk about. And then finally, when I talk about the court generally, I say it's an exciting time to be watching the court. And I guess it's exciting if you're happy about what they're doing, and maybe less exciting, but also must-watch TV if you're less happy about what they're doing. But I think there's a lot that's coming down the pike on the separation of powers front. And I just want to quickly tick off a couple things that we should watch. And some of these issues, especially with the election results this week, could come to the fore very, very quickly. The five things I'm looking at. Number one, is there going to be a real test to the Humphreys executor doctrine? Is President Trump, once he takes office, going to take a shot at firing the head of an so-called independent agency? I think that would tee up and present the question of whether independent agencies really are allowed anymore and whether Humphreys' executor should be overruled. Second, there's been talk in recent days about creative uses of the recess appointment power. Ed Whalen's been blogging about this. Don McGahn had an op-ed on this a few days ago. I think it's a really interesting issue, and it seems like President-elect Trump has been tweeting about recess appointments, so we might see that come to the fore and tested very quickly. Third, impoundment. Elon Musk has been pushing the idea and is, I think, have been appointed to run an outside commission that's going to talk about cutting costs, saving money. And I think the President-elect Trump has advisors who have made the argument that the president has fairly robust powers to decline to spend money that Congress has appropriated. There's a 1974 federal law that places significant restrictions on that. But that might be another area where the Trump administration might take some action that would prompt legal challenge or prompt issues to come to the fore. Nationwide injunctions, I'm going to go out on a limb and predict that the new administration might do some controversial things and might get sued in a bunch of places, maybe even Judge Bress in your circuit. And the courts are going to have to deal with requests for nationwide injunctions. Last time President Trump was elected, same thing happened as well with President Biden. There are all sorts of programs that are going to be controversial, are going to be challenged, and I think maybe the court will have to ultimately decide whether nationwide injunctions are okay. And then the final thing, I think the new administration is going to be very interested in deregulation, and we're going to see how the decisions last term in Loper Bright and Relentless, how those play into deregulatory decisions by government agencies and whether courts are going to be reluctant to defer even when agencies are deregulating as well. So a lot to watch and a lot on the agenda going forward.
Great. Thank you so much to Roman and to all of you for these helpful and really insightful comments. Great way to kick us off. So what we're going to do is we're going to break this discussion down around four key cases. We're first going to go through and have a discussion around Loper Bright. We're then going to move to the major questions doctrine and non-delegation. We will then talk about jarcossy and then the presidential immunity case. So Roman is going to take the lead in kind of setting the table on Loper Bright, and so we'll turn it back to you.
Great. Well, so Loper Bright, I think a lot of you know the case is about overturning Chevron deference. Let me just say a quick word or two about the factual posture, because I think it sort of illustrates the problems with the deference doctrine as it existed. The Loper Bright and Relentless, they're two cases, but they essentially involve very similar clients and very similar sets of facts. The challengers to the Chevron doctrine were both commercial fishing companies in New England. There's a federal law that says that these companies commercial fishermen had to have federal observers on their vessels to collect data for the federal government, for the Department of Commerce, so that the federal government could carry out its responsibilities to monitor the fisheries. No one disputes that the government can require people or did require people by statute to have these observers on their boats. The issue is that the government ran out of money to pay for the observers. And so instead of finding more money in the federal government to pay for the federal observers collecting the federal data, the government decided that it would issue essentially a regulation that said, going forward, even though we've always paid for the observers ourselves, from now on, the commercial fishing industry is going to have to pay for the observers. and they estimated that the costs of this regulation could be as high as 20% of the annual profits of some of these very small commercial fishing companies. So to take a step back, what basically happened is the government ran out of money and they invented a tax and they imposed it through regulation. And they did so without any statutory authority to do that. So what did they do when they were challenged? They said, well, the statute is silent, which means it's ambiguous, which means under the Chevron doctrine, we have discretion to impose this new cost on the industry. That was challenged. The petitioners, so the challengers in both cases lost in district court, they lost in the Court of Appeals, and the case came to the Supreme Court. And obviously the issue was whether to overturn Chevron deference. We made three arguments, essentially, for why Chevron should be overturned, each of which we presented as an independent basis for winning. Number one, we said that Chevron was unconstitutional. It was unconstitutional for a couple reasons. The principal one we emphasized was that Chevron essentially requires Article III judges who have a duty to independently interpret and apply the law. It requires them to abdicate that interpretive responsibility and essentially in close cases where the statute's ambiguous, give that power to the agency and defer to the agency. We said that was an Article III problem. We said it also violated due process because individuals, citizens who are fighting the government in individual cases, they would have the close calls decided not by an independent judge, but by their adversary in the litigation. Secondly, we argued that Chevron violated the Administrative Procedure Act because Section 706 of the APA requires courts to interpret relevant provisions of law. It doesn't say that courts are allowed to do that by kind of subcontracting the interpretive function out to agencies. And third, we said that the internal justification and logic of Chevron deference was wrong. Chevron had been defended on the ground that there was like an intentional delegation to agencies by Congress to resolve ambiguous questions, and we said that this delegation theory was just fictional, that Congress did not intend to delegate. And we said that even if you didn't agree with us on the Constitution or the APA, that was the justification for Chevron. If that justification didn't hold water, Chevron should be overturned. And what, you know, we've all seen the decision. I think what the decision essentially said is, I view it as us winning on 2.5 of our three arguments. The court definitely rejected the delegation theory. Its main holding was based on the Administrative Procedure Act and the language of the APA. So we definitely won on those two grounds. The court did not reach the constitutional arguments that we had put forward, but the court, in its analysis of the APA, essentially agreed with us that the APA had codified sort of the longstanding understanding of the judicial power. And so all of the arguments that we had made in support of our historical arguments in support of the constitutional theory that we had put forward, we essentially saw in the opinion as being sort of the backdrop for the APA and the basis a significant part of the basis for interpreting the APA the way we did. So I don't think we lost on the constitutional argument. We didn't win on it in the sense that the court didn't adopt it, but the court adopted a lot of our analysis. And so I think going forward, obviously a very significant decision as a theoretical matter, in terms of you know, telling courts and agencies where their lanes are and how they have to stay in their lanes with respect to the interpretation of statutes. There's some ambiguities and caveats in the decision, which I'm sure we can get into. But I think it's very important as a theoretical matter, and I also think as a practical matter, it's also going to be significant. Chevron applied to an important but somewhat narrow range of cases because it had been narrowed over the years. But I think the signal that's sent from the court's decision is one that applies more broadly and that lower court judges may internalize even outside the narrow context in which Chevron used to apply. And I think the general lesson from the decision is the Supreme Court telling lower courts, it is your job to make sure agencies play within the rules, stay within the lines, and don't exceed their authority. And I think that's an important lesson that goes beyond the decision in Chevron, overturning Chevron itself.
Great. I want to ask a few questions coming out of this, and I'm going to ask Russell to kind of tackle the first one, but I welcome the panel's discussion. What is the role of agency deference at this point? To what extent can or should courts still defer to an agency's views on the meaning of a statute?
Yeah, so I think we're returning to a better understanding of of judicial or statutory interpretation where we're not completely disregarding an agency's interpretation, but it fits into the broader context of the interpretive enterprise. And so you're looking at what's now being, I think, called Skidmore respect or weight. So not deference, but weight. Has the agency maintained this view for a long time? If so, that could be relevant evidence to how it was understood when the statute was originally enacted. And the consistency can show that this wasn't something that was politically motivated, but actually a genuine interpretive exercise. By contrast, when you have these scenarios where the agency adopts one view of a statute and then flip-flops and adopts a diametrically opposed view of the same statute. So you see this in the net neutrality litigation, for example.
Get their rights. You know, isn't it a little weird that we could do that without a jury and just stick them in front of an executive branch official? Like, I think people would think, wait, what? That's allowed? No one would think that that's how it works, because usually they think that when you have adjudication happen, it's in front of a court, and the court's going to look at the issues independently, and they're not going to be part of the entity that's prosecuted. So I kind of think the court shares some of these concerns, and I think what Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas are trying to do in a number of these cases is start to lay the groundwork for a broader range of attack against other types of adjudication that encompass, you know, not just rooting those attacks in the Seventh Amendment, but also in Article 3 and in due process, because I think it's fundamentally unfair.
We want to leave time for questions, but we also want to cover presidential immunity, and we're going to hear from Russell on that. Russell, I'm going to just lead us off with something Ilya Somin wrote soon after the decision. He wrote that the most striking aspect of the decision is that it offers virtually no originalist or textualist support for any of this. So with that, why don't you go ahead and present?
Great. So it was an unprecedented case. So Jack Smith indicted President Trump on charges of conspiring to overturn the 2020 election. President Trump moved to dismiss the indictment on grounds of presidential immunity, and the case made its way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court was very candid that there is no direct precedent on point here. It's gleaning from other precedents involving other immunities in slightly different contexts. I'll describe the holding of the court and then maybe speak to the critique. What the court held was that it's kind of a three-part holding, that there are certain powers that fall within the president's conclusive, preclusive authority that for which the president is absolutely immune from criminal prosecution. There are certain official acts that go to the outer perimeter of his responsibilities for which the court said it was adopting a presumptive immunity, to which I will return in a moment. And then the court articulated a third category of actions that are unofficial actions for which it was clear that there is no immunity. Now to the charge on the originalist, historical analysis, I think actually when you look at the first and the third categories, it's actually pretty straightforward. So the first category, these are the core executive powers, things like the pardon power. These are the things that fall within the president's exclusive authority by the text of the Constitution. There's actually very little dispute, I think, among even the dissenters that category exists. They might have some debate about what fits into that category, but it really ought to be very straightforward from the text of the Constitution, that this falls exclusively within the president's authority, so there can't be a criminal prosecution for it by definition. You flip to the third category on the unofficial acts, and there is no immunity. And so the court was very clear. So you have the Clinton versus Jones case for civil damages. You have now the Trump versus United States case for criminal prosecution. For unofficial acts, there is no immunity. And so it's really that second category that is the more, I guess, controversial one. And I consider that second category to actually encompass two categories of conduct. The court phrased it as a presumption. To me, it's two categories of conduct. One category is official actions that pose dangers of intrusion on the authority of the functions of the executive branch. The court is very clear that category of conduct is immune from prosecution. That category comes from the Nixon versus Fitzgerald case about civil damages. I think it follows very naturally from that decision that if you can't have civil liability for your actions within the scope of your authority, you certainly can't have criminal liability for actions within the scope of your authority. And so I think that builds naturally on really what is the only historical precedent there is. And then there's a different category of actions, at least hypothetically, where the court says, if the government can show that applying a criminal prohibition to that act would pose no dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch, the court phrases that as, then you've, you know, I guess, rebutted this presumption. But it's interesting, the court doesn't resolve whether there is immunity for that category of actions. It sort of says there is at least presumptive immunity for the other category. It really doesn't say anything about this category. And so I read that actually to say, if you perchance find something within the president's authority that somehow does not pose a danger of intrusion, you know, criminalizing that would not pose a danger of intrusion on his authority and functions, sort of come back to us and then we'll decide if that's immune. That's how I read the decision. I don't read it to bar immunity for that. I don't read it to really express an opinion on it. And so I think the charge that it's not historical, when you kind of go through each of the categories, I think it's not a fair charge because this hasn't come up before, and it's very consistent with the precedents that do exist.
Let me ask Luke to see if there's any connections, and the answer may be no, between this and what we saw in Loper, Bright, and Jarkissi, because one thing the Chief Justice in the presidential immunity case talks about is the need for a vigorous executive. But obviously we see the court, at least in the context of administrative agencies, not exactly sponsoring the view of a vigorous administrative state. So how do you reconcile these, or are these just two different cases with two different issues and they're really not linked?
I think there is some tension, and part of that owes to how you're defining the executive. The court is clearly very concerned about the president himself being chilled. At the same time, the Chief Justice, since basically his confirmation, has been sounding the alarm about overreach by administrative agencies. So I do think that there is some possible tension there. You could try to resolve it by pointing to the very unusual nature of this case and saying that this is a case that has a potential to chill the executive branch as a whole in a way that overturning Chevron really does not. I mean, that really returns to the way that things were for a long time in this country, whereas this was an unprecedented prosecution and could have had unprecedented results in the country. So I think you can square that circle, but there was not really an attempt done in the opinion to address that.
Let me ask one more question of Roman, and then we're going to have time for questions from the audience. Roman, the court at various points cites Justice Jackson's concurrence in Youngstown Sheet and Tube, actually several times, which set out this sort of similar tripartite format with a zone, a twilight zone in the middle. For difficult questions of separation of powers, is something like that framework almost inevitable, or do you believe that was a conscious choice on the court's part?
You know, I think it's hard to imagine that the justices were not thinking about Jackson and Youngstown, just such a seminal decision. And I know, Chief Justice clerked for Justice Rehnquist, who clerked for Justice Jackson. And, I just think it's such an important opinion that they obviously had it in mind. You know, I think the challenge, frankly, and this applies probably to Justice Jackson's opinion as well, but I think especially in this decision, I think there's a lot of ambiguity and fuzziness here. And I think the court, in the talking about the middle category, left a lot of unanswered questions. First of all, I don't think the court was, made clear that that presumption could even be rebutted. I think they said it was at least presumptive immunity. And so they left open the possibility that in the middle category, it's actually absolute immunity. I also think that it was just unclear where the lines were to be drawn within that middle category and what was in it. Justice Barrett's courage seemed to think that if a president took a bribe for some official act, that you would be able to prosecute. That came up a lot at the oral argument. The majority opinion, the chief's opinion, didn't really address that hypothetical. It was almost like, why? Why didn't it address it? Is it because it was leaving that question open? And if so, that sort of suggests that there's a lot that just hasn't been resolved. And so I think that, whether you're thinking about Youngstown or this case, the framework is maybe helpful to organize the analysis, but the challenge is still going to be to get the details right, and it's not totally clear that the court provided a, you know, an administrable rule for the ages in the way that, that maybe it, it thought it could do.
So let's see. I know there's some microphones that may be circulating if people have questions. The only thing I'll say is let's make them be questions, and if you want to make a statement, you'll be invited to be on the panel here next year. does anybody have questions? We have, yes, sir.
Hi, Ben, visiting from Seattle. We've seen a couple important cases overturned the last couple of years. I'm wondering, in this context, are there some other cases, you've mentioned a few, that you think might be subject to overturning in the next few years?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I do think the consumers research case, the question about whether or not, for example, the universal service fee is a tax, and whether or not there was a non-delegation or a vested powers question there. I think that sometime within the next 5 years, but I'm hoping within the next two, the court will do something on the vested powers issues. Because we have a case, I have a case that is nothing but a vested powers question, non-delegation for all the rest of y'all. And so I think that the court has signaled that it's trying to bring that up, and I think that's going to be one of the ones that's important to look at.
Ramon already mentioned this, but I think Humphrey's executor is on the chopping block, and that's, to my mind, the next big precedent to fall.
Yes, in the back we have some questions. We'll get you a microphone.
Who are we pointing to?
Either one. Go ahead. We'll do one and then the other.
Hi. I'm sorry. Mike Isaac from Tampa. The panel didn't discuss executive orders, so I'm wondering if perhaps somebody or whoever wants to chime in, at some point, is the executive going into the congressional lane through the use of executive orders and in order to effectuate policy? And how far do we let them go? And where is the court going to say too much executive orders is violating the separation of powers? And where are we going to find that line?
Want to jump on that?
Sure, yeah. I think it's an important question. And I think that, you know, it's incumbent on the next administration to make sure that they don't cross that line. I think there have been challenges. I'm thinking of DACA, for example, where these types of issues have come up. Biden versus Nebraska on student loan forgiveness. Like, I think this is where the major questions doctrine can be really helpful, because often these executive orders are implemented through agencies, and then you're then in the APA context reviewing whether they've exceeded statutory authority that they have. So I think that can be a way of getting at it. I'm curious if the panel has other thoughts. That would be kind of how I would think of it.
One of the things that I know, this isn't where you were going, but I would love to see challenges to executive orders under the Antiquities Act, where they're designating monuments, because I do think that in those orders in the last 10 years or so, the president has strayed into essentially regulating and has gone beyond and to policy making in violation of some other statutes. And so that is a set of executive orders that I think is ripe for challenge. And again, some of the justices have sort of signaled that they'd like to see that.
Yeah, I agree. Executive orders might be ripe for further development of major questions. One of the criticisms of the doctrine is that it seems to put a thumb on the scale against regulation. And when we think about the upcoming administration, I imagine a lot of what it's going to be doing is deregulatory. But executive orders are one place where you might look for more aggressive executive action that courts could presumably check through major questions.
Wait, we had another question, I think, at the same table.
This is Roman for you. How strong do you think the argument that ambiguity is a delegation to do policymaking really is? Because at step one of Chevron, the court exhausts all of its potential tools to do statutory interpretation. So the point is that if you get to step two at all, you actually are not doing interpretation anymore whatsoever. So how do you deal with that argument? And then if it is not statutory interpretation at step two, is it an impermissible delegation for the courts to resolve the issue because it's policymaking?
Yeah, so I don't think that litigants are going to have a lot of success making the argument that just ambiguity means it's a delegation of policymaking authority, because I think that's the sort of a very close cousin of what the court rejected in Loper Bright and Relentless. I think instead, the kinds of statutory language that are going to be treated as delegations of policymaking authority are phrasings that are kind of vague but not ambiguous, or maybe that, you know, for example, if the statute says something like, you know, the agency shall enact reasonable rates for, you know, X fee or whatever, you know, or shall reduce pollution of this pollutant to a reasonable amount that's consistent with public safety. I think a court that looks at that kind of statutory language might think that the agency is being delegated some discretion to make a policy judgment about what level of pollution or what kind of fee or rate is reasonable. And that's different from saying, well, it's just reasonable, it's just an unclear term. We don't know what that means as a matter of statutory interpretation, and so we're going to defer to them to interpret it. It's more about, like, actually what they're asking the agency to do is apply policy expertise. And I think that's the category of cases where maybe agencies are still going to be able to prevail, even under Loper Bright. But as we said, you know, then that says that sort of raises the question, well, oh, if you're just delegating policymaking authority, that sounds like delegating legislative authority, and legislative authority seems to be vested elsewhere, so how does that work? And that's where we get into the broader non-delegation question.
Questions here in the middle of the room.
Yes, thank you. Paul Kaminar, D.C. attorney. Regarding the immunity ruling, obviously it's unclear what the contours are, as you were talking about, Russell. Now that Jack Smith is winding down his cases, the January 6th case here in D.C., the court will not, you know, give any opinion on that. But however, in New York next week, Judge Bershon is going to rule whether or not the immunity ruling applies in that case because of testimony of Hope Hicks, discussion with Donald Trump at the time. So my question is, do you think that is the only case that might finally get to the Supreme Court so it'll put some flesh or contours on the extent of the immunity, or is this not going to happen for a long time to get some clarity on the issue?
Just a clarification, are you talking about the documents case for the business? Is that?
Well, no, both would be. I mean, the document case, that was dismissed because of the appointments clause.
Yeah.
That's before the 11th Circuit. But both of those are going to go away one way or the other. So the immunity is only raised in the D.C. case.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll see how that goes as well.
Yeah, I think it has the most direct application. I'm curious if others have different views. I think it has the most direct application to the D.C. case because that's where he's personally implicated. I think, you know, in terms of the business, it would be interesting to see. But I think the justification for the immunity is one that is personal to the president. Discharge of duties in office. So I think the court probably was glad to kind of resolve the case and let it go back down, and probably would be happy if it didn't get explicated further, is my take.
I agree with that. I haven't followed the New York case a lot. I think you're right that it obviously raises some tricky questions because there was an evidentiary portion of the immunity ruling that arguably applies to the New York case. I don't know how strong or weak those arguments are, but I totally agree with Russell. I think the Supreme Court wants to be done with this. So if they can avoid having to weigh in, I think they would probably take that path.
I agree with that. The only other option that occurs to me to sort of expand on this is there are a number of cases that have been brought against other people that were in President Trump's orbit, and many of them have tried to invoke some form of immunity for themselves. So far, that's not been successful, but that could change, and that could be a basis for further clarification as well.
Hi, Albert from Washington State. I wonder if any of you would hazard a guess as to, after Loper Bright, what other agency practices might be on the chopping block, or if there are any other cases already percolating up that would be decided differently under that than they would have been under the Chevron doctrine.
So I think there are a lot of agency programs that are being challenged, and now you know, the parties litigating that are calibrating their arguments in light of Loper-Bright. I will say, I think there's another very big issue that's affected by the Loper-Bright decision that has not been resolved, which is what is the state of our deference? So as I know many of you will remember, our deference is closely related to Chevron deference, but instead of deferring to agencies when agencies are interpreting statutes, it's about deferring to agencies when they're interpreting their own regulations. And five or so years ago, the Supreme Court upheld the our deference doctrine on stare decisis grounds. And I think there's a real question about whether that holding in a case called Kaiser is still good law, given that the Supreme Court has now conclusively interpreted the APA to say deference is not allowed. So on the one hand, people might say, look, you know, the court considered the our deference issue 5 years ago. It upheld it because of precedent. That logic still holds. It's still precedent. And so our deference still is alive. On the other hand, litigants or people challenging the government might say, it upheld the decision only on precedential grounds. It did not interpret the APA novo, and now the court has weighed in and clarified what the APA means, and that means that our deference has to go. I think that's a major issue because there's so many places in which agencies are taking action or, you know, affecting regulated entities based on their interpretation of their regulations, and I don't think that's settled yet, but I think that's going to be a major follow-on question to Loper-Bright.
I think one issue that raises is how much does Loper-Bright disrupt existing precedent? So the court had a paragraph on stare decisis in the opinion, and there's been some debate about the scope of that paragraph. The narrow reading of it is that the only thing that receives stare decisis effect is the actual holding. Upholding a prior rule is consistent with the statute, and that is it. And so if a new rule comes up, even if it involves the same reasoning, that there wouldn't be any deference shown, and that you would be able to then completely reinterpret it. There's a broader reading of that paragraph that tries to kind of give stare decisis effect to the rationale that was used to uphold the prior rule. And so I think which rules could even be reassessed, I think, depends on how the courts decide that issue.
Yeah, one last question. Yes, sir.
Brian Bishop from Rhode Island. And in 1999, I first came to this meeting because it was one of the only hits I got on the internet for the non-delegation doctrine. And it's a really data. I searched on Alta Vista. So it's and obviously now we're actually having the rubber hit the road versus the idea of a theory of the non-delegation doctrine. I'm wondering if especially Zonette, given your practice, if you think that American trucking was a case almost ahead of its time and might have come out differently. I believe it was 8-1 the other way. And that to me was at the time was the zenith of the non or an attempt at reinvigorating the non-delegation doctrine. And it was that case brought too early, or are people going to relook at American trucking or a case like it?
It was brought when it had to be brought, right? So it wasn't brought too early, but I don't know that American trucking, I think that it very much depends on how the cases come up and what the statute says, and particularly where there are technical issues involved in the statute. I don't know that it's gonna make that big of a difference. I do think that it's one thing that loops in with jarcossy and the non-delegation or vested powers issues is this question of public rights. And I think that what the court is focusing on without really addressing it, you know, whether it's the Seventh Amendment, whether it's Article III, whether it's the Fifth Amendment, is this question of do you have an individual right, right? And that then sort of triggers this non-delegation analysis, because when you look at the way that non-delegation or potentially improper delegations have won or prevailed in the past, it's because largely they involve things like privileges, like public lands or resources or something like that. And I think that what you're going to see is a move of this public rights analysis together from jarcossy into this non-delegation discussion as well. I think that the court needs to take that up. I would like to think that American trucking would come out different today, but I think it just depends on the way that it's brought up.
Well, all the panels at this conference are great, but I think this has been a uniquely thoughtful group. I want to extend my thanks to each of the panelists, and please join me in thanking them.